One of my favorite things that I've ever learned about George Washington is that, do you know he ran his own spy ring? So it's called the Culper spy ring. So right off the bat, we got spies. Immediately, right off the bat, we got spies in the White House. I'm already having a blast on that one.
All right, welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that's digging deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the casual history connoisseur, and my co-host, Eric Mason, a brilliant loose cannon economist who's bringing a wealth of knowledge and the wildest historical facts to the table. Sum up what we talked about last week, we kind of looked at the background of George Washington. We learned that he was not necessarily a status seeker like everyone seems to think he was. I mean, how else would he have stepped down after two terms? All indications show that his marriage to Martha was genuine and love-filled. We learned that there's actually not a whole lot of information about the guy, too, in his early years. Sounds like the record keeping was not all that great in the early colonial periods.
They didn't know he was going to be president.
Right. Well, that helps, too, right? You don't really keep track of a nobody until they become something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Also, the other thing that I found very fascinating that you mentioned that kind of low-key slipped in there, but he said he was 6'2". Like, what was the average size of people back then? Like, what, 5'8"?
Yeah, so the colonists were relatively tall because they had excess nutrition, but no, it was about 5'5", 5'6".
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, most of the data we have for average male height at this time point, I believe it actually comes from military data. Obviously, people were going to PCPs.
And those are probably the better fed. They're going to be. That actually is an issue with collecting statistics. From the military services, you have a much more fit population that you're collecting that data from, and it can actually skew your results.
Yeah, and then it's like, well, how many short or overly tall men did you decline? Because then now they're not part of the average, unless you're Frederick the Great. Did you know that? Did you ever hear that story?
What? That he only brought big giant men for his army?
No, he had He had a brigade of super tall gentlemen that would follow him around to her soldiers. I don't know if they ever went through training.
Right.
Frederick the Great is literally one of the most interesting human beings to ever live. And we should do an entire, if we don't do a three-parter, we should do one episode of Frederick the Great.
Yeah.
Because he was a brilliant military leader who was also posh as all get out. And his dad was just angry, general. And he was I'm going to be probably the most dominant general of my time period. But I'm also gonna be dope at chess and know a ton about wine. He's fascinating. We'd have a blast about him. Kyle, I do like that you call me a loose cannon where I am probably the most parochial human being on the face of the earth.
I don't know about that. I mean, I've not been able to put guardrails on you before in any of these recordings.
I meant more on my professional and academic side of my life. I tend to be very parochial.
I was feeling more like a bewildered police chief. Like, damn it, Eric, you did it again, but fuck if you don't get results.
I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with the many times Kyle and I have shared economic and financial conversations. I can be quite fiery, so he is correct.
Real quick for you, I just want to finish that thought on the military statistics things. There's something that I actually learned when I was going through the nuke power program. They kind of talked about there was a point they had told us that the people analyzing the data of radiation exposure for Navy workers came to the conclusion that radiation was good for you because they didn't realize that they were actually taking a much healthier subsection of the population.
Yeah, there's I have type 1 diabetes, and some of my favorite studies are people being like, oh, I saw a study one time that said the more Diet Coke you drink, the more likely you are to develop type 1 diabetes.
I've seen that one. I've repeated that one, I think.
Yeah, and I'm sitting there going, that's interesting, because type 1 diabetes is autoimmune disease, and we don't really know what causes autoimmune diseases. Usually it's genetics. Type 1 diabetes is a genetic tract that causes it. So I read the methodology, and the researchers thought the methodology was stand in a grocery store aisle, ask people buying buying Diet Coke if they have type 1 diabetes, and the answer was yes. Oh, and they were like, oh, brilliant. I made a Boolean indicator for that.
Yeah, oh, that's perfect correlation, yes. Causation, right?
Yes, and I'm I do love probit modeling, but you are a clown if you use probit modeling in that way, and I hope whoever did that study is listening to this, and you can call me, and I'll show you how to build an actual model. like an adult.
I have no idea if that's actually going to make this into the final cut, but...
Well, I was like, you can't threaten people who are listening to the video, Eric. Jerk. I'm tired of your shit.
Let's get back to our summary here. Do you have anything else to add to recap from last week?
No, I think it was... I think that will be the most unique recap we do in this entire series, because it was... You know, it was a lot of trying to stick to what we know and of it. We have good source knowledge from, like, good ripples. We're not trying to over-exaggerate, under-exaggerate anything. But now we get to move into, I think, the funner stuff. We get to move into what is it, you know, into the military side. Like, we're not going to go, this isn't going to turn into a Revolutionary War podcast.
No, that may be a separate special episode at one point. I think we do need to go back and revisit that.
Yeah, so we're going to move more into like the major economic events of his life as he becomes president and goes through literally founding a country.
Did we talk about his appointment? Like, should we just start there and then maybe go from there to the decisions that kind of shape that term?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to go. Yeah, absolutely.
One thing that I was noticed when I was doing the barest of research was that he was not affiliated with any political parties. So were there any at this time when he ran?
Yeah, so there was two. So he ended up being, his first term, he ran unopposed. His second term, he ran as a Federalist. Mm-hmm. So there were Federalists and Anti-Federalists, which, talk about horrible naming.
Yeah.
You know, smartest people ever to live. They couldn't think of a different adjective or noun. So, yeah, so the Federal, this is where, we discussed last episode about how Washington, despite being from Virginia, was... believed in, you know, the national government, believed in it was a unionist, I guess what you'd call it in today's lingo. That's why it was kind of bizarre when he joined the Federalist side. It's like, wait a minute, you're a Virginian. Why, you know, Virginians were largely anti-Federalist, states' rights, all that stuff. And he was, because he believed there was no strength without Federalism. That's because he had just lived through the Articles of Confederation, where the government couldn't tax, the government couldn't really raise an army, could do all this stuff. And if everybody could tweet at Kyle to let me do the Articles of Confederation episode, which
yes,
nobody will watch because it will just be so boring, but it's a wild time in American history. It's like, what would happen if the states had more power than the federal government and their own militaries? What? No, it's not. Europe.
They had their own economies too. Like, all the own states had their own currencies.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it was a mess.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure, like, they try to set up tariffs between certain states. But, yeah, I mean, the Articles of Federation were wild. So, you go through the election of 1788, and he runs as no political party. He's the only president ever to be elected without a political party. He hates political parties. Kyle, you're 100% right. Washington's farewell address heavily critiques a two-party system or any political parties. Believed Americans should vote for Americans.
Really?
Oh, yeah, Now, the reason he joined the Federalist side, there's many reasons, and there's many great historians. I encourage anybody who hears any topic that we talk about is go do your research on it.
If you get it wrong, call us out, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely do that.
We're all about truth here, or the accuracy.
Yeah. Just, can you link your source? Can you not just be one of those people who comments something, and then I'm like, I don't want to go do this research. I did a ton of research. I want to know where I was wrong.
Reddit is not a source.
Yes, though some of those dudes on Reddit, I'll give you credit, when the person on Reddit does the source, it's kind of like Wikipedia is not necessarily a source, but you go to the source section and you're like, oh, guys have some good sources here.
Right.
But yeah, so it is fascinating. So he runs. Now, the reason he was a Federalist, from a lot of people believe the reason he was a Federalist was because he didn't view Federalism and Anti-Federalism as two political parties.
Mm-hmm.
He viewed Anti-Federalists were people who were still wanted the realities and the pains of the Articles of Confederation. They did not. They were anti a federal government. And then there were people who wanted a federal government. He was like, I'm the president of a federal government. I should probably be okay saying I'm pro-federal government.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So I used to teach youth and government for a local community center in my hometown. And one of my favorite parts about it is I got to teach about federal governments, and everybody thinks a federal government and national government are synonyms. And I'm like,
I would have thought that.
Yeah, so a federal government is a form of national government. Not all national governments are federal governments, but all federal governments are forms of national government. So you really have three types. You have what's called a confederacy, like the Articles of Confederation, where the states that make up the nation have way more power than the nation as a whole.
More like the EU organization when they put that together, kind of?
Yes, that would be an example. If you're familiar with Greek history, I'm sure there's some Greek history nerds out there. Exactly like that. That's why the Peloponnesian Wars, right?
Yeah, it was all about the city-states in Greece.
Bingo, Kyle. Yeah, right on, buddy. Yeah. Then you have a central style of government. In a Confederate style of government, all the states basically manage their own stuff, and they'll come together for national defense, but a lot of times, historically, they end up fighting civil wars. Like, if you have a Confederacy, it ends up fighting a civil war, either against itself or against what it's rebelling against. It doesn't work. I'm not trying to be mean. I'm sure there's, like, some situation. Like, I was going to say Russia right now basically functions. Russia calls itself the Federation of Russia, but it has, like, large Confederacy components where, like, there's certain nations that are on the peripheral of Russia that have, like, a ton of autonomy that would never exist in you know, a normal federal system.
But then they're also constantly fighting Chechens and Georgia and...
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, like, oh, dude, I guess my Civil War rule still works. Yes, I was about to say Russia disproved me, but no, it doesn't actually. Good day for Eric. So, then you have a centralized government. That's France is the best example. France is usually like the hallmark example of centralized.
Which version of France?
the Fifth Republic, the one that is as old as my parents. Don't forget, we are going to talk about, whether it's this episode or the last episode, we are going to talk about Washington, his opinions on the French government, because they are interesting. He is an interesting man. Where the top pushes all the way down, that the states have no independent authority. Both Confederate-style governments, confederacies, and centralized governments have very large pain points when it comes to economics. Centralized governments tend to be too slow. Mm-hmm. And because they're so slow to make decisions and bureaucracy, they tend to be very, very uninnovative. It's why a lot of European nations fall behind in innovation. It's definitely innovation relative to capital investment and median income. Those are two things that should drive innovation. Confederate style, there becomes too much trading friction. So what you end up having is all these individual city-states that only want to be best for them. Sparta wants what's best for Sparta. Athens wants what's best for Athens, but it's not what's best for Greece.
Right.
So they end up putting up trade barriers, and you have non-uniformity of law, and it goes on and on. It's just really becomes infinite. It's death by a thousand paper cuts. But then we have the federal system of government. Now, what the federal system of government is there is a national government that is supreme, like a Supreme Court, whose laws are the law of the land. But everything that's not explicitly mandated by the federal government is at discretion of the states. In the United States, I've made this argument publicly that a few different speaking events have done. One of the best things in the Constitution for the economic prosperity of the United States, one is the Navy. The Navy, the amount of...
unrestricted trade.
Right. Like 85% of all trade travels on the ocean. And the 10th Amendment, which basically forces state... It's why you don't need a different driver's license to go state to state.
Okay.
That reduction of trade barriers between states is so amazing. And each state can kind of customize its policies for its individual economy that optimize it. So in Massachusetts, where we have ultra-high education, ultra-high cost of living, and all this other very modernized economy, we can make modernized economic policy decisions. But then when you have developing areas of the country, like take the Dakotas, for example, they can pass different types of legislations that can make it easier to start a business. I mean, both the Dakotas are doing excellent, too.
Yeah, that's why you see states sometimes have those tax cuts for businesses to incentivize them to move over. They have the freedom to do that in a federalist form of government.
Yes, and the federal government enforces things like contract law across the entire country, the rules of business across the entire country. Disputes are settled, and precedent can be used across the entire country. These are all things that make it easier for business. It lubricates the means of production. These are very, very important. It's only available at the federal level of government. Mm-hmm. But there's one more thing that Mr. Washington did as he formed his first cabinet. And there's a certain kind of famous person who I actually... full disclosure, I'm a little bit of a... What do you call it when somebody finds a band that gets angry and everybody else finds that same band?
Oh, rap. What is the... You are a hipster.
Thank you. I am a hipster.
Presidential... You're a Quincy Adams hipster, aren't you?
Oh, first off, you will not enjoy the John Quincy Adams episode, because I will make an argument that he... There should be... I think there should be... Everything should be named after John Quincy Adams. That man was amazing. He was 100% right about everything. And I will argue that to the death, and we will have fun. And it will also be problematic during the James Monroe episode. And cards on the table, I'm a huge James Monroe fan also, but we're going to talk about the Monroe Doctrine. Kyle's like, we're not getting that far.
No, we are.
No, we are. Alexander Hamilton has been one of my favorite founding fathers for my whole life. And then some awesome guy makes a cool play about it, and suddenly I have to... I find other people who are like, I love Hamilton too. And I'm like, oh, all the... And I start talking about National Bank, and they're like, I don't remember that song.
Okay.
Or they don't know he's from the Caribbean. How he died. Sorry.
You don't like those tangent. Hamilton bandwagoners?
Yeah. Hey, no, that's what they are. The Hamilton bandwagoners. You're 100% right. Pay $700 to see a show. You can't even read about literally one of the coolest dudes ever to live. So early on in Wash, one of the biggest economic policies that Washington did when he came on is he assumed states' debt.
That seems like a brilliant move, too. How else do you get the states to be completely dependent on the new federal government that you're trying to implement? Because the debts of that Revolutionary War...
Oh, you took it in a bad way, Kyle. What's this going to say?
Yeah, if you want to make a federal government that the states have to rely on, you have to incentivize them to do that. And by taking the massive debts that were created during the Revolutionary War...
Massive debts.
Massive. Yeah. How long did it take to pay all that off?
Oh, about the 1830s. It was about 1833, I want to say it was.
Wow.
We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to Jackson and the crises of the terminating of the first national bank. Because this is really the national bank is what George Washington oversaw with Hamilton. But no, Kyle, you're 100% right, though. They got tied together economically, right?
Yep.
You're 100% right about that. So Washington came in there, and he was like, okay, we're going to pay all the national debt. So it's very funny. I hate to be one of these guys because I have a lot of love and respect for history teachers, especially some of my favorite history teachers. Some of my favorite teachers were history teachers. But it's always funny to me as they say, yeah, George Washington formed the National Bank and assumed all debt, state debt. So states don't have debt anymore. And I'm like,
wait, states can't have any debt?
No, states have tons of debt. I don't know why that gets taught in history classes.
I was gonna say.
Municipalities have debt. Yeah, every state can still issue debt. They can't issue debt to foreign nations. That is what George Washington outlawed.
Oh, that is smart, too.
And so basically it's like Massachusetts can issue bonds that can be bought by anybody. But Massachusetts just pays a clearinghouse, and then they administer all the debt. That's what, obviously, Kyle, you know this. That's what underwriting is. But we can't go to France and be like, yo, France, can I get like $2 billion to rebuild the Sagamore Bridge?
Right.
Believe it or not, that is not a theoretical thing. Back in during the Cold War, the state of West Virginia needed a new bridge, and the federal government wasn't going to pay for it. So they went to the USSR and asked if they could build the bridge. And then the U.S. government gave them the money to build the bridge. For anybody listening to this on a podcast, I am wearing a WVU shirt right now, and I very much love I love West Virginia, but that was a wild move by them, and I respect it.
That was ballsy.
So basically, the best way I can word what Washington did from an economic standpoint, early on his presidency, he was a true Federalist, even if he didn't run as part of the Federal Party at the beginning. He said, the federal government is the sole representator of the United States on the global stage. That is it. Individual states do not get to represent any national interests. You can represent state interests, but we represent national interests. So if it's okay with you, Kyle, can I set the scene with members of his cabinet?
Yeah, do it.
All right. So first off, we have my fellow Quincyite, somebody who, growing up, I would play baseball and stuff, or play catch on various members of his family's front yards, even hundreds of years later, and who I currently work about 60 feet from where he's buried. Our boy, John Adams. No, so back then, you know, it's before, we adopted the modern presidential system of candidates running, which was still, there was still the Electoral College then. Washington cleaned house, but second most votes went to Adams.
Oh, I thought he was unanimously elected.
So George Washington ended up winning, out of 135 electoral college votes, he won 69, which is, it's before the modern candidate system that we see with presidential parties. So there was about a dozen people running, and he got pretty much just shy of half of all the votes, electoral college votes, which is, I know in the United States, we don't often use a coalition style of voting. It's always, you know, a binary voting pattern. But in a, if you have any coalition election and some guy walks away with 50% of the votes, that's like,
that's insane. In
a binary system, yeah, it's like somebody winning with 80%.
Yeah, that's a landslide.
Kyle, can I give you a quick trivia?
Yeah.
Because I got this wrong. My number was so far off when I guessed this, all right? But I don't want to tell you what my guess was, okay, because I don't want to bias you. How many popular votes do you think were cast in the entire United States in that time period?
In the first election?
Yes. Now, mind you, real quick, I want to give you something.
I would guess there's about, 13 million population in the States maybe around then? Or is that way too high?
How many people are actually... I think it might be, you're actually probably right now. Real quick, the Carolinas were territories and hadn't gained the right to vote yet.
Okay. So we figure there's probably...
There was a total of, in 1790, the first census, all right, there was 3.9 million people, 2.4 million free white men and women. This is coming right from the U.S. Census. Mm-hmm. And 600,000 slaves. How many popular votes do you think were cast in the first presidential election?
I would guess maybe 200,000 to 300,000.
All right, so you and I, very similar page. So when I started putting down some notes for this, and I was like, oh, I'm curious about what his election looked like, and you know, the people voting. When I started falling down that rabbit hole, I assumed it'd be like 10% turnout.
10 to 20 is my guess.
10 to 20, yeah. Right. 28,000 votes.
What?
Yes, 28,000 votes were cast in that election. And I'm sitting there going, that's 1% of non-slaves. Now, I get it. You got to be a man. You got to own land.
Yeah.
But that still seems...
That seems way minuscule. Low. Yeah.
So we talk about, like, oh, the president. Like, oh, yeah, the first president. How this big consensus about George Washington being elected. He won the Electoral College in a landslide, but...
The rest of the world didn't really seem to give a shit.
Yeah, let me put it this way. If you had a college football game and only 20,000 people showed up to it, you'd be like, wow, nobody showed up to this game. And that was just who chose George Washington as the first president of the Constitution.
Right.
No, so it's just absolutely fascinating. So Washington gets in office. We have John Adams. Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, one of his fellow Virginians. Alexander Hamilton making up the Secretary of Treasury. Alexander Hamilton, kind of interesting. So he was born in the Caribbean. So there's always this interesting discussion of could he ever run for president. Obviously, we never get a chance to discuss that. But yeah, him and Jefferson did not get along very well. Jefferson running, you know, theme with Jefferson, he doesn't seem to ever get along with anybody.
I was going to say that. That was actually going to be my comment.
Yeah, I was about to say something mean.
I was too.
Henry Knox was the Secretary of War. So where Fort Knox comes from.
Oh.
Funny story about Henry Knox. So early in the Revolutionary War, you know, he's fighting a series of battles out in western New York, and he ends up capturing these cannons. I believe they were from, I think it was from Ticonderoga.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, he dragged those cannons back and put them on the outskirts, on Dorchester Hill, pointed into Boston Harbor, and forced the British to leave. And Henry Knox's in-laws were these like really crazy devoted loyalists, and they ended up fleeing, and he never saw them again.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
He was just like, got his in-laws to leave via, I get the threat of cannon. By that, kind of a funny story. Like, honey, can you not point the cannon at my parents?
Right. that probably made all the Thanksgivings better for him.
Then the last major member of the cabinet was Edmund Randolph. He was the Attorney General. So real quick, especially since we're going to be talking about economics, I just want to make something real clear about the Attorney General position at this time.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't what the AG is today, where you're talking about one of the most powerful people in all of the U.S. government.
Okay.
At this point, the Attorney General was kind of not really even seen as a cabinet member. And I know today you probably wouldn't call the Attorney General a cabinet member, but in terms of us setting the scene for important people and important decisions getting made, I feel it'd be weird to leave out, leave out the Attorney General.
Right.
But his whole job was to basically be the sounding board for Washington when Washington wanted to do something to see if we'd violate the Constitution. Think of it. This man who just got elected had really no formal education and is now trying to piece apart one of the most complicated documents in U.S. the basis of U.S. law. One of the most complicated documents ever written. Kind of a good idea to have one dude who's a really good attorney. You could be like, real quick, got a couple questions for you, buddy.
Habeas corpus. How important is that?
Is that a type of dip? So, yeah, obviously we're not going to dive too much into each of these individuals, members of the cabinet, but just to keep them in the orbit. I will say at this point, the vice presidency, nobody really knew what to do with it. He was basically supposed to be the head of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
But John Adams was known for just, like, making fun of people in the Senate. Like, he would just make fun of people.
Really?
So he was a star. I have a bunch of John Adams quotes around my office, but one of my favorite, and I'll probably bastardize the quote a little bit, he basically said, it doesn't really matter how many people think you're wrong if you're right.
Mm-hmm.
You got to imagine, this is a man who wrote the first, like, the most modern constitution in the U.S. The constitution that he's now the vice president of is based off his constitution, the Massachusetts Constitution. James Madison's amazing, but him and James Madison basically was like, I'm going to use the template.
Mm-hmm.
Even things like, I know we don't associate it with Massachusetts now, but the Second Amendment comes from Article 15 of the Massachusetts Constitution. Like,
right.
All these things. I don't know if Adams was like super pumped that the part of his constitution that outlawed slavery got dropped from the U.S. Constitution. I think he was a little bitter on that, and then being surrounded by a bunch of Virginians.
Yeah.
And then sitting in a Senate.
I mean, honestly, would they have been able to have gotten the buy-in from all the southern states if they had left that in there?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You're 100% right. They got the end of the slave trade in 1808. So basically, they said 20 years into the slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson has a famous quote where he called slavery a wolf by the ears. You're holding a wolf by the ears. If you let it go, is it going to run away or attack you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, Adams didn't really feel that way because he was like, I don't have slaves. I don't have a wolf.
Right.
I manage my own stuff. God, I love Adams. So yeah, so these are the players. Right off the bat, this whole thing goes awry. I mean, immediately there is disagreement of where the federal government even has what it has the right to do.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from, does it have the right to mitigate trade? Does it have the right to borrow? Does it have the right to form a national bank? Every single thing that Washington did, there was a group on either side that didn't want him doing it. And they constantly were, is this what the Constitution was supposed to be? Isn't this what I signed up for? All this. But it was held together for what I believe one reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was George Washington. It was one of the saddest, not saddest, but most emotional moments in American history is after the end of the Revolutionary War, Washington starts addressing his men.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, the men hadn't been paid. There was land promises. This new country was just getting formed. And Washington went to read a speech that he had prepared. He couldn't read it because his eyesight was so bad at this time. So he took out his glasses and read it. And these angry and verbose troops that, were upset at what was going on were stopped what they were doing because they basically saw this larger-than-life character, this man who had led them through a horrific war, fighting the most powerful military on earth, and he was seen as Superman. He was Superman.
Mm-hmm.
Who was so beaten down from years and years of war, basically told them that, guys, I know this isn't great right now, but we're going to do our best to help you, that it wasn't even the words that came out of his mouth. It was that presence and stature that really subdued what could have been a pretty volatile incident. That's his entire presidency. America is not what America is today. There's tons of debate whether or not George Washington was a great president in terms of policy. But he was a great man. And he was a great man who led who people had a hard time rebuking. Fast forward 8 years, when John Adams becomes president, people had no problem telling that dude. He probably had no problem telling those dudes off.
Right.
And that's fun. That'll be more fun. That's going to be a lot more fun discussion. But right at the bat, this just gets wild. Like, so, Kyle, one of my favorite things that I've ever learned about George Washington is that, do you know he ran his own spy ring?
Yeah, I actually did know that.
Oh, come on.
I have heard that.
Of course, you Navy people.
I don't remember where. I don't know much of the details, but I've heard that before.
So it's called the Culper spy ring. And it was, so it existed before his presidency. It was really, really cool. So it existed before his presidency. We don't really know how many people were in it. We really don't know like that too much about it. From what we understood, there were six spies mm-hmm. that really were like the core. Now it is talked about, they bought information and stuff like that. They brought on more people, but there was like this core six, and it was awesome because it was basically like the CIA long before OSS
right.
and long before everything else. And I really think that speaks a lot to the type of guy that Washington was, where it was, he wasn't this like country, you know, bumpkin, not knowing anything. Oh, I did not have a good education. He was a smart man. He was a surveyor. Even today, you'd be pretty smart to be a surveyor with modern technology.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't the best general. He didn't win a ton of wars, a ton of battles, right? But he was smart enough to slowly erode in a trip and keep morale up against the most powerful, unstoppable military on Earth that owns the oceans. Like, he right. was smart enough to put people in the right places to go over to Europe in, in get support of European nations.
Right.
He was a smart man. He was a smart, smart man. And he knew intelligence comes from intelligence, right? The ability to make a smart decision comes from knowing what the other side's doing. So right off the bat, we got spies. Immediately, right off the bat, we got spies in the White House. We're already having a blast. We're already having a blast on that one. So Mr. Washington gets into office. And some of the weird stuff that starts happening is that there was the continental currency collapse of like the mid-1880s. So like people like just...
Mid-1780s, you mean?
1780s. I say 1880s. Yeah. It's like the railroads and we're still using continental currency. So Washington gets in office. He has his spies, you know, which is obviously a blast. You have the remnants of this continent, of the continental currency crisis. And basically what happened to the continental currency crisis is Kyle brought this up last show that like the states were so segmented, they had their own money. And on top of that, all of the states were borrowing money and just printing money and just making money to pay the troops that they were sending to fight the Revolutionary War. The Revolutionary War ends. The Brits aren't like super cool with us and they still own the entire ocean. So we need to like get trade going again. So we're trying to do that. We're trying to have some sort of taxes. We're trying to become a nation.
Right.
And nobody has money to pay anybody back. So you just end up with that underlying faith in that currency falling out. And once that happens, you know, it creates this negative cycle. We basically go back to a barter economy for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So Washington's like, dude, we can't be a barter economy. Like, we were an economic juggernaut at this point, right?
Right.
And then immediately to a barter economy. Absolutely wild. So Hamilton wants to form the first national bank. The first national bank gets formed in 1791. And, you know, the national bank, it's not like the Federal Reserve. It's
mm-hmm.
Federal Reserve is a, you know, you could argue is a form of a national bank, but don't think the Federal Reserve being like the national bank today. It was more there to provide stability and to maintain and increase the trust in federally issued greenbacks at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It did that through co-ownership. It was, you know, both privately and publicly owned. It was a true bank. It was a real bank, not kind of like a Federal Reserve, which is really just a vessel to control monetary flows.
Was the founding of this bank the reason for, was it the Benjamin Franklin quote that banks are more dangerous than standing armies or something along those lines? I probably butchered that quote too, but
no, that sounds like a Franklin quote. Probably, yeah, because this is right around the yeah. Franklin would have been pretty involved in this. So for George Washington's administration, they assumed the debts of states in 1790, immediately formed the national bank, which gets chartered in 1791. In 1792, we have the first financial crisis in the United States.
Nice.
It's like, I'm not joking. Yeah. It's literally like the, yeah, just... All right, guys. I know you don't trust continental currency. I know we're all scared of that. But here's what I'm going to do. It's like, yeah, what are you going to do, Georgie? All right. So, step one, we're just going to form a national bank. Everybody's like, okay, so what's national bank going to do? It's going to, all those crazy currencies, we're going to have one central currency, right? That's going to work in, well, Massachusetts, but now modern day Maine,
right,
all the way down to Georgia. It's going to be great. Everybody's going to love it. And everybody's like, oh, cool, cool. And he goes, and before we open the doors to that, give me all your debt. Every state, give me all your debt. We'll pay back France. We'll pay back Portugal. We'll pay back Spain. We'll pay everybody back on your behalf because we're a federal system government. He was like, dude, this is kind of good. I kind of like this.
Right.
Like, I'm a fan. And then like 13 months later, massive panic. it was horrible. So the Great Panic of 1792, as it's called. I always find that funny when they put the first one's called great. And I'm like, what was your point of reference?
Right, yeah. What was the panic that was not so great?
Yeah, right, the small concern of 1888 or something.
The tepid worries of 1778.
So it was basically caused by stock manipulations.
We have had a long history of that.
Yeah, which is almost like every panic is basically, except the panic of 1837, the panic under Jackson, where he was just like, I'm closing the national bank. And everybody's like, can you not do that? And they're like, massive recession. And he's like, see, Nicholas Biddle caused this recession. It's like, no, you did. Like, why did you shut down the... Imagine if somebody just was like, no more Federal Reserve. You'd be like, wow, that seems like a bad idea. Can we talk about it? No, nope.
Right.
I don't like Powell. It's like, oh, you didn't even have a good reason. You just don't like the guy.
Right.
But everything about Nicholas Biddle is all the paintings of him look like old Renaissance paintings. It's just, that will be what's behind me, Jerry.
For next episode, we'll get Biddle up there.
Oh, it's so exciting. I actually low-key love Nicholas Biddle. Because he was just such like a fire me, I don't give a shit. Because he was already like super rich.
Right.
He was like, I don't go home. I don't care. I think Jackson didn't like him because nothing got under. Like, he would threaten Biddle all the time. And Biddle was just like, I have so much money. I don't need to care what you think about me. I don't know that. So.
Panic of 92.
Panic of 92. Stock market manipulations. A couple different things caused it. There was a ton of false stock certificates going around. There wasn't really a regulatory body for it. And it collapsed. It was actually the first time the government ever intervened in... it was like the first major government intervention mm-hmm. that we've ever seen in the financial sector. The government came in there was like, yeah, there was many things they did, but the big clip notes one is really the validation of stock certificates and stuff like that. Stuff that I would argue is probably pretty swell to have.
Probably should have thought of that beforehand. But I mean, like you said before, there's a bunch of 19-year-olds like trying to think of a new system of government. Like, yeah, there's going to be some things that slip through the cracks.
Yeah. And I think it's the Constitution was excellently written as a tool of governance, but it obviously isn't a financial document.
No.
So I think it added layers of complexity to it. While that's happening, yeah, this all happened like during Washington's administration.
Right.
So the bank like gets stabilized and the panic of 1792, you know, kind of resolves itself and, you know, people get back to going. There's still a lot of grounds to make up because like, you know, for lack of a better term, like they're still recovering from the Revolutionary War. So, you know, in the course of recovering from war, there's going to be this like kind of natural push driver of rebuilding
mm-hmm.
that kind of pushes your economy up. Obviously it won't help relative to where you would have been before, but there's yellow fever pandemic in Philly. Oof. At the time that got like so many senior leaders sick.
Ooh, well, that's not good.
Yeah, so he had a financial collapse, he had a pandemic, he had formed a national bank, took over all the debt, and while he's doing this, one of my favorite Washington stories, Kyle brought this up in one of our pre-meetings that Kyle loved, the Whiskey Rebellion.
Yeah.
So now this is not the first time the government had to suppress a rebellion. All right, the first rebellion that ever had to be suppressed was the Shays Rebellion, which took place in western Massachusetts. We're not going to get into the Articles of Confederation because I want to save that for that show. But just if you ever like in a bar, like, what's the first rebellion after the Revolution? It was Shays Rebellion. Very boring. No, I'm joking. Not very boring.
I remember that one more than the Whiskey Rebellion, at least.
Yeah, so the Whiskey Rebellion is awesome. So it's a bunch of good old boys in Pennsylvania who were very angry about an excise tax on whiskey. So... I don't want to take credit for Kyle's joke. Kyle made a lot of great jokes about like the Whiskey Rebellion when we were talking about it.
Yeah, I just think it's baller. It's pretty fucking ballsy to just get done fighting a war about taxation and representation and to immediately go and put a tax on whiskey. Maybe you might want to give a little bit more time between those events happening.
I love that he was really, really banking on that without representation.
Yes.
Subordinate yes. clause. Yes. He was really banking on like on that.
Well, you're represented now, so now we can tax.
Yeah. But yeah, so but why it's sick is because, so economic panic, yellow fever epidemic, establishing a new central bank, Washington leaves, because the White House didn't exist yet, Washington leaves the Capitol to lead troops into battle. He was a dude who showed up to Western Pennsylvania.
Wait, Washington?
Yep, Washington still remains really? The only sitting president ever to lead troops into battle while sitting president.
Can you imagine being one of those rebellers? And then the president just shows up and they're like, what are you guys doing? Not only that, but he's like leading an army behind him.
Oh, who shows up? The sitting president with an army. Oh, and this dude is the George Washington of generals, because he's actually George Washington.
Right. All right, I'll go back to work.
Yeah, you lose that, right? Yeah. You lost that. I mean, just absolutely, absolutely hilarious.
I don't think it had the same effect if John Adams or Monroe or Hamilton showed up to that event with the troops. It just doesn't have the same.
John Adams would just went and like yelled at people.
Oh, he would have showed right, them legally actually, where they were wrong.
Right here, I wrote both these documents. Get away from me. Yeah. It's like, sir, yeah. I just want to be able to drink my whiskey. He would be like, he's like, I'm a congregationalist. I don't drink. That probably would have been his response. Yeah, so it's really funny. So the Whiskey Rebellion gets suppressed. It was like really, what's cool about the Whiskey Rebellion is that Washington didn't want to go in there and like beat these people senseless.
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted to show, and I think that's part of the reason he led them into combat. Because, like, don't forget, Washington was very good at empowering junior officers. Like, he wasn't this guy who had to go do everything. But I think he wanted to show how important this was. That, No, you can get taxed. We're a free nation. We're no longer attached to the Brits. We have to be taxed. And I think a lot of people around the country saw that as, honestly, they saw that as a positive. Like, Okay, these are the rules. The government's going to step in. And at the same, simultaneous to him restoring order, he's also standardizing national debt. He's assuming state debts. So he's taking all these things away from state-level decision makers, but still not taking the governance away from individual states for day-to-day operations.
Mm-hmm.
But then in 1792, the Coin Act of 1792 comes through, and it creates U.S. Mint. And it was a dude, the early U.S. Mint was a mess. They were making like half cents. Notes and stuff like that. Like, they had no idea what they were doing.
Right.
Which is wild, because the U.S. Mint is probably one of the most well-run organizations in the world.
Now.
Like, today.
Yeah.
Yeah. These people were goofy back then. They didn't know what they were doing. Which is wild to me, because it's not like, dude, you were British, like, 7 years ago. Just adopt the same exact model of the pound sterling, right, which has existed forever at this point. So I like to think it was like kids rebelling. No, I'm not. I'm going to wear slippers. I'm going to wear flip-flops in the snow because you told me to wear boots. It's like, I'm going to have half cents. It's like, what does that even mean? Yeah, so wrapping back around to the whole U.S. Mint, the Coinage Act of 1792. See, it's very funny. I think when we look at history and we look at it retrospectively, we kind of think it was like, oh, this is very well thought out.
Right.
The U.S. was like, we are going to assume debts. We are going to pay these bills. We are going to form a U.S. Mint. No, that's not what it was. It was because there was a massive counterfeiting epidemic going on, because everybody's like, oh, there's no national government. Let me just like make my own money. Why wouldn't I do that?
That makes a lot of sense.
Yes. It wasn't this like, oh, well, let's all these philosophers sit around and let us conclude what is the greatest action to do. Nah, it's like, hey, Bill, I keep getting like fake $1 bills every time I go down to the corner store to buy some grain. And can we do something about that?
Isn't that why they put like the ridges on the coins too? Because people were like scraping them off and like making them smaller than what the actual coin was and melting the metals down.
Yeah. No, that's why coins. Yeah. That's why more higher valued currencies have ridges.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I kind of, as we talk towards the end of some of the funner stuff of George Washington's time in there, and you know, certainly discussing it. There's always so much to learn about George Washington. Colin and I have said before, we hope this, if you're listening to this, it makes you interested in something. I mean, you can't do justice to Washington's entire presidency, you know, just in a few 45-minute, half an hour long podcasts. That's not fair to the man. But we can talk about some fun stuff. But one of my favorite moments in George Washington's presidency is the French Revolution. So often called the Sister Revolution to us.
Oh, I never put that together. Those kind of happen like right next to each other.
Yeah. So they were called Sister Revolutions. I guess me and my brother are kind of different. So I guess that, so you can have different siblings. But the American Revolution was like, oh, we have philosophers fighting for this concept of, you know, equal representation and taxation stuff. And the French were like, what if we chop off a bunch of heads and get rid of the calendar?
We'll just get rid of all the politicians.
Yeah.
I think we've heard that before.
But like, or like, you know, at no point during the American Revolution was somebody like, guys, no more calendar. We just have 10 days. Every period's 10 days. Like, Robespierre was just like, got rid of the calendar.
What?
Yeah, because he thought like the religious aspect of the calendar was like bad, so he just wanted like 10 days of 10.
Wow.
Yeah, so like very similar to what Washington did, right? No, wait, no, Washington led a military that very, what do you call it? Very like in a civilized manner defeated another military, not like let's chop off a bunch of like innocent people's heads. I often have asked this question when people have said, if I've heard that term, they're sister revolutions. I'm like, but the French Revolution wasn't a revolution, it was a civil war.
Yeah, no, what happened after the French Revolution? Napoleon.
Yeah, Napoleon. Like,
that's kind of the opposite of what we did, isn't it?
Yeah, followed by another king, followed by Napoleon III. Like they're...
Right.
Kyle knows my thoughts on France. So the French, the Committee on Public Safety, which was the oligarchy that ran France in the early stages of the French Revolution. Yeah, that was, they were called the Committee on Public Safety. That was their name.
Oh, that's a fucking brilliant name.
Terrifying name. So they ended up, forming this, so they ended up appealing to Washington. They're like, hey, Georgie, can you come over here and help us in this war? And he was like, yeah, so my deal was with Louis XVI. Where's that dude at? They were like, he's fine. All his appendages are attached to his body. It's like, what? Why'd you say that? That seems, makes me suspicious. No, he's perfectly fine. There is nothing wrong with him. He's level-headed. It is, his wife is fine too. no need to come over here and ask that. Could you just send some military support? And he was like, nope, you're not the same government. So you don't have the authority of France. So I low-key love this dude who just, you know, threw out a monarch from his country, was like, another monarch was, people wanted to throw the monarch out of their country, and he was like, no, my deal is with that monarch.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they provided a lot of support for the Revolutionary War. I mean, I could see why France would be, coming over and be like, hey, remember how we helped you out? Could you guys reciprocate some of that?
So, controversial opinion here, Kyle. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. In that case, say Louis XVI was still alive, and he asked for help too, who should we help?
I don't think we should get involved at all.
And this took option C? What the hell?
Country? At this stage in our country's development, we've got plenty of shit to fix on our own. We do not need to be trying to go project force across an ocean.
You're like, we have 250 years to do that?
Yes. Like, let's build some of the foundations. Let's get a fucking navy founded first before we try to send troops over to Europe.
This is the only time we'll ever do this.
Right. Editorialized thing we said we wouldn't do.
So Washington basically ends up saying to the French revolutionists, no. And
yeah,
I think that I think that started a shift that inadvertently accomplished exactly what Washington wanted to do his whole life. Mm-hmm. Washington always viewed himself early on in his life as a British subject. Washington did not wish for the Revolutionary War to happen. If you talk to 22-year-old George Washington sitting in Fort Necessity, signing a piece of paper that he couldn't read, basically a French piece of paper he couldn't read, saying that it was his fault and he's surrendering. If you had asked him what he would have wanted to happen in his life, he would have told you he wanted to be a great British general, that he wanted to be British nobility.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't have said, I want to form my own country. He would never have said, I'm going to, I want to be dealing with the headaches, the yellow fever epidemic, the counterfeiting issue, and all that stuff. He would have wanted to be a British subject.
Or quashing rebellions.
Yeah, quashing rebellions, exactly. Leaving the capital to go quash a rebellion.
Right.
And after that's all said and done, he's sitting there. He's climbed to the top of his country. He's seen as this monolithic man, as a superhero, but basically like as great as you can be and be mortal. And he has the opportunity to get involved, you know, in international affairs and maybe repay the French for what the French gave the Americans during the war. And he says no. He says no because he doesn't. And in fairness to Washington, I fully believe he didn't think it was the same government. And France has had five republics since in the last 200 years. So there have been more than one government. And that little move right there accomplished something that 22-year-old George Washington probably would have loved, which is it put the United States on a path. It would take about another 60 years, probably the Venezuelan border dispute, for the U.S. and Britain to develop what Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher described and what many presidents and other British PMs have described as the special relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That one move, because then the French were like, oh, these guys aren't helping us. And the Brits, I think even England was kind of confused by that. And that made America the system it is today, I think. That the rules that we are supporters of a rule-based world order.
Mm-hmm.
It is fascinating that one of his last acts of being president really reinforced something that earlier in his life that he really wanted to see himself and his nation, or I should say his colonists do, which is be true subjects, you know, have representation and, you know, be part of the overall United Kingdom. And one of his last acts really did something even better. It didn't create them as subjects with the Brits, but as I would describe it as the fiercest alliance in the world right now is the Brits and the Americans.
Yeah. Yep. I would agree with that. You would think helping France revolt would have been a feather in our caps with the Brits, though. And I thought they didn't really get along with France too well. But they also probably like monarchies being still around. So overthrowing a monarchy is probably a dangerous time to be king.
Yes, that would be. I was going to say, yeah, it's why the Western Sahara is not recognized today. It's like, we just don't want to talk about any of that. I mean,
well, I think we probably got to the end of part two, though, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, well, I could talk about my love for Mr. Washington on and on. This is probably, we probably reached the end of this part.
I think we've gotten through the what we meant to cover for part two. Next week, we will be looking at, though, the other key people and events that shaped Washington's legacy, where we can dive into more of those people that made up the cabinet and some of the other maybe ancillary events that happened around the world during that time. But in the meantime, just let us know your thoughts on the first president's policies. Where does he rank on your all-time list of the greats? Email us at chinashopproductions@gmail.com, and you can visit the website at thebuckstartsherepodcast.com to stay up to date, and we will see you all next week.